This is Merritt saying that we're not in a state of peace with Russia.
Drone flights, espionage, the Tiergarten murder, massive threats to individual public figures, not only in Germany but also in many other European countries. Acts of sabotage on a daily basis. Attempts to paralyze data centers. Cyber attacks. I suspect that here in the room, probably every second person has already been affected by how their data networks and infrastructure have been attacked. We are not at war, but we are no longer at peace, and we must be clear about this if we want to meet the challenges we are now facing.
What do you think he means when he says we're not in a state of peace and we need to be? What is clear and what should those policies be?
Well, I mean, there's a political motive here. Germany's trying to ramp up its defense spending. It's not super popular. Their economy is not doing great. There's a lot of controversy. I just came back from spending a week there, and there's a lot of controversy around the increased defense budget, whether or not they're actually going to be able to do it. There's also a lot of self-congratulatory, patting on the back of how great they're doing and how they're leading the rearmament of Europe. But if you scratch below the surface, you find that, you know, there's things happening, but it's not clear that they're like adding up to much. And so I guess I see these remarks as sort of like a political tool to make sure that the money keeps flowing, to make people feel like there's a threat. You can't get people motivated about paying more taxes so that they can fund defense industries if they believe that there's no threat. So this idea that we're already at war, you know, trying to mobilize people. But kind of makes me laugh a little bit because, you know, if you really think you're at war, then wouldn't you be acting a lot more like urgently? Wouldn't you be building things up a lot more quickly? Wouldn't you be expanding your military much more than you are? You know, when we were at the one of my, you know, visits was to a military command college. And one of the comments that was made was, well, this isn't a place where we train warriors. It's a place where we train advisors. And I was like, what? Like,
wait, what?
You know, that does not scream like we are at war. That screams to me like, you know, we're still in the post-Cold War, like peace dividend world where it's nice to, you know, train leaders, but not train them as warriors. So I do think there's a disconnect between that rhetoric and then what you actually see happening on the ground.
And now let's shift over to Poland, a little bit closer to the Russian border now. And a lot of bad blood, a lot of bad history between the two. And he almost says if Merz was saying we're not at war, but we're not at peace, he seems to go a little bit further.
With all these provocations from the Russians and Belarusians, for me, it means that today it's absolutely obvious that we have to stop all this kind of illusions. The first illusion was and is that there's no war. It's in some of us, we like this definition like full-scale aggression or incidents or provocation. No, it's war. A new type of war, very complex. But it's war.
Yeah, but is it war? Because I think what you just said is really applicable here. If the Poles think that they're at war with Russia, seems like they'd be doing more than just talking about it.
Well, the Poles are doing a lot. I mean, they have ramped up their defense spending a lot more than other countries. They have bought a ton of artillery and tanks and other types of heavy weapons and ammunition. They are building up their military force. I do think they are behaving as if there is a real threat and probably will end up with one of the most powerful militaries in Europe when this is all said and done. And that's great for like Europe as a whole in some ways, except that Poland has never really been about like European defense. They're about Polish defense. So they have not always been good about like thinking about how, you know, what would Poland do if Estonia was attacked? Like, that's not the conversation. It's what would Poland do if Poland was attacked? So that's great for Poland. But it's not necessarily the solution for the rest of Europe. I'll also note that, you know, Poland is often excluded. You know, when the E3 meets, sometimes Poland is left out. And I think that's a mistake, too. I do think we should recognize that Poland is becoming a major defense center. At the same time, I do think that you saw with the drone incursions that, like, you know, there was a lot of tough talk, a lot of panic about these drones that were surveillance drones. To me, that doesn't scream like, you know, we're ready for a war if you're going to panic over 19 surveillance drones. So, again, there's a little bit of a disconnect, although I would put Poland and Germany in pretty different camps.
And that's on the kind of the pro war camp. On the not only no but hell no war camp is Slovakia and Hungary, led by Viktor Orban. And he, at this same conference, in the Copenhagen conference, was pretty clear about where he stands.
Who's the main threat against Europe right now?
Provocation.
No, it's a real question. Please, Prime Minister. Sorry,
so
Prime Minister.
The real danger, Europe, yeah. Economic stagnation and losing competitiveness. This is the danger.
Not Russia?
Sorry.
Not Russia?
No. We are stronger than... So, okay, guys. So we are stronger than Russia. Make some comparison and base your opinion on the facts. So we have more than 400 million people, yeah? Russia is 130-something. Look at the European GDP. It's like that. Russia is like that. We spend altogether 27 more on military spending than the Russians. So why we are afraid? We are stronger than they are. The question is whether we have...
I love you when you use my argument.
Whether we have leadership to come together and to defend our interests together. Trump. That's what we should do anyway.
And you are accusing Donald Trump.
So he is not backing down, because Tusk had some pretty comments, directed comments towards him, as did Zelensky, by the way, by name. But doesn't seem to be bothering Viktor Orban any. Does he have a point there, that the real issues for France is not Russia, but it's economic? I said France, I meant Europe. It's economic and other kinds of stagnation.
I do agree. I mean, I don't think Russia is a big threat to Europe. I think Europe needs to spend a little bit more to build up some of its defense capabilities, just so that it has enough military power to be geopolitically relevant. But yeah, economics is more important. Russia is not a big threat, especially now.
Now, I talked to Alexander Mercurius on our show, I think it was yesterday, and he argues that he is told behind the scenes that a number of European states actually agree more with Orban than they do with the Macron, Starmer, Tusk et al., but that they can't say anything out loud. Do you have, from your travels, do you have any idea about, is this just Slovakia and Hungary and this tiny little group, and all the rest of the European states are like Tusk and Starmer, or how do you think that's divided actually?
No, I mean, I do think there's a wide variation of threat perceptions of Russia. They tend to be more concerned the closer you get to the border with Russia, and less concerned the further away you get. But I think there's a wide variation of how concerned leaders are. I think, most leaders are saying publicly that they are concerned, partly to get the defense spending up, partly because, this is, useful for making sure that Trump stays in the United States. If Russia's a threat, we can try to convince, Trump to stay in to help with the Russian adversary. But I do think that for a lot of countries, Russia is not a big concern.
And I think that should be the case with the United States, because no matter how you want to slice this and dice this, as you said in your foreign policy piece there, it is in no way, shape, or form an American interest in having any kind of a conflict at all with Russia. And I hope that continues to predominate, and hope they follow some of your advice. Before I let you go, though, I would like your comment on something that came out really odd from the administration here a couple of days ago. It kind of caught me by surprise, and that is that the United States, President Trump, basically just declared that assuring the security of the state of Qatar. And in this, he makes a really strange statement to my ears. The United States shall regard any armed attack on the territory, sovereignty, or critical infrastructure of the state of Qatar as a threat to the peace and security of the United States. We've been talking this whole time here about that we need to get disentangled from the European side and not get into potential where we get drawn into a war. And now here the White House seems to be saying, let's add someone else to the list. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of dismayed at this. The last thing the United States needs is to be extending more security guarantees to countries in the Middle East, given the current unsteady and unstable security situation in the region. I mean, a couple of caveats. Number one, I'm not sure you can extend a security guarantee by executive order. I'm not sure that's how it works. So I do think that this is a little bit flimsy. It's not like Article 5. The next president could easily discard it. President Trump could easily ignore it. Number two, because we have 10,000 U.S. forces in Qatar already, sort of it's just a statement of the de facto situation that we're in, which is that if Qatar's attacked, it implicates the United States, and the United States will have to decide how to respond. because we have so many forces there. So, you know, I'm not sure how much of it is a change in policy. But I do think that this, you know, stems a lot from the Israeli strike on Hamas negotiators in the country. Both the need to, you know, smooth things over with the Qataris, as well as, you know, send a little bit of a signal to Israel, like, don't do that again. You know, like, this is serious. This is a major partner of the United States. None of that, though, makes it really any better. This idea of constantly extending security guarantees to more and more countries is a huge problem for the United States and creates major risks of entanglement and future war. So, you know, I'm just hoping that this sort of fades away, like the Rio Treaty has faded away, in the sense that we still have these commitments and we ignore them, rather than becomes this sort of like ironclad thing like we have with NATO or Japan, things like that.
Well, certainly hope that's the case as well. Just a real quick bonus question, since we have a few minutes. How do you see the possibility for renewed war between Israel and Iran, or the U.S. involved with a war with Iran? Or do you think that we can muddle along and have no more restarting that conflict?
Yeah, I think it's going to restart. I mean, I don't know when, but I don't see how the Israelis are satisfied with the outcome of the first round. It's pretty clear that Iran still has the ability to produce nuclear weapons, that any setback was pretty minor. They still have the intention to do so. They haven't returned to the negotiating table. So I guess I see the risk as pretty high. I'm hoping that it's not a near-term risk, that we're talking like at least a year or two before we have to, you know, replay the June scenario. But you just never know with Netanyahu, because a lot of this is motivated by his political future and his political goals. And for him, more war secures his political position. So overall, I guess I'm pretty pessimistic. You know, right now it seems calm, and I've been focusing a lot on Russia, Ukraine. So I'm just kind of trying to pretend that's.
You know, I interpreted the reason why the so-called 12-day war came to an end was because all three parties needed it. You know, America needed it because we were giving away too much stuff, and we just couldn't get into an open-ended conflict where we just kept giving more and more of these precious missiles that we have, defense, air offense, et cetera. Israel needed it to end because they were taking lots of hits, that their Iron Dome and their integrated air defense systems couldn't block all of them out. A lot of them were being very painful. And Iran needed to be out of it because they were also taking lots of hit. But I don't see anything that's fundamentally changed from those dynamics.
Yeah. So a pause, maybe.
So if the thing got restarted, you would still have the same risk for Israel, if not even more so, because some argue that the Iran has now continued to develop and build more, manufacture more of these missiles that can get through. So how could Israel restart it and not go back to suffering those same casualties?
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with you. I think that we're in the same situation. Like, that the problem with the first round of strikes was that it didn't fundamentally change the situation. So yes, I agree with you. We needed a timeout because missile stockpiles were running low, but the fundamental problem hasn't been resolved, and it won't be resolved militarily, only resolved at the negotiating table. So, you know, I guess I'm pretty pessimistic on the whole Middle East portfolio.
Yeah, well, we can just hope that enough time passes where the cost just is recognized to be too high. And maybe people just finally say, okay, let's just have a deal that we can live with and let that be it. I hope that's the case. But yes, I know that's a thin hope. I agree. But it's
Friday afternoon, so we have to hang on to something.
We do. We got to have something. I agree with it. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. I know you got another overseas trip coming up this time, I think, to Ukraine. And we'd love to have you back on the backside of that and let us know what you've discovered there.
All right. Well, I'll be happy to report.
Cool. Look forward to it. Thank you very much. We thank all you guys. Hope you have a great weekend. It's been a great week for the Daniel Davis Deep Dive here. We hit 250,000 subscribers. We attribute that to you guys and your loyalty and your faithfulness to share this with other people. I ask you to keep doing that. Really do thank you, and look forward to seeing you with a bunch of new shows next week on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.